It's about time.
For what?
We have to meet the moment.
What is the moment?
I'll show you right now.
Okay.
What's going on, Titans? Welcome back to another episode of Daily Titan Podcast, or DT Pop for short. In today's episode, we're going to be breaking down volume 118, issue number 10 of the Daily Titan student newspaper. In this episode, we're going to be going over a couple of stories, including one about a classic haunt. We're also going to be talking about Cal State Fullerton's Ollie program. We're going to go over an opinion about American values and entertainment, and we're going to wrap it up with talking about a little bit about men's soccer. Stay tuned, Titans. And before I forget, I'm one of your co-hosts, your layout editor, Kabir Kansar, and I'm joined with
Damiana Gabriel, your co-host and assistant news editor.
Stay tuned, Titans.
I'm feeling really scared right now.
Dude, me too.
It's just, I don't know, something's making me nervous.
It's just some ominous presence. Like, there's almost like another person here.
Oh, I think I see her too.
You know who it is?
Sarah Leone, managing editor, is that you?
Yes, it's my bright white light that's come into this podcast just to talk to you.
Oh my god, about what?
About this amazing haunt called the 17th Door, where you have to sign a waiver in order to get in.
Not a waiver.
Oh, what does this waiver entail?
This waiver entails the fact that not only are you going to be succumbed to electric shock, but you also will be suffocated for 10 seconds in latex, and you could also die, maybe.
Oh!
But what if I don't want to do these things?
You can always say the word mercy, or you can buy a mercy pendant, and they won't let you do it. Everything's based on consent there.
Okay.
Wow. How long has the 17th Door been around?
It's been around for about 10 years. They're on their 10th year anniversary right now.
Wow. So how'd you find all this information out? Did you go?
Oh, I did go. Oh, and as your amazing managing editor, who rides or dies for this paper, she went to report on it, and she went in.
Oh, tell us more about that. How was it?
I didn't want to go in at first, but
reasonable.
The awesome photographer that I was with really, really wanted to go in, and I refused at first, but then the owner that I was interviewing told me that it'd probably be really cool for my story if I went in. And I did agree with her, and so, to his surprise, I said yes, and we went in.
Oh.
So.
Let us know about what you experienced in this haunted house. I'm actually dying to know.
Well, it's like, it's story-based from beginning to end, and it's extremely immersive. So, I'm a huge horror fan. Like, extremely, I love horror. I've been watching horror movies since I was like 4 years old with my mom. So, not much really scares me now, except for, like, haunts and attractions and horror attractions and things like that. This one wasn't necessarily, scary, but it was more intense from how immersive the experience is.
Yeah, and I think you talk about that a little bit in your article about, the difference that the owners, themselves draw between, their haunt, the 17th Door, and other haunts that are kind of a little bit more crowded, like Halloween Horror Nights or
that's why a lot of attendees go, actually, is because a lot of them want to experience something that is not only not crowded and not something where you're just kind of wanting to rush through a line or rush through a little maze just to see it, but it's something where they actually put you into the story. They interact with you just like they would if you were on a stage doing, acting this out yourself. You are put into the story. They interact with you in character throughout the entire thing.
Yeah, and are the 17 doors, each themed different things? How does that
differ? Yeah, what's the dynamic play into it?
So, basically, for this theme, you are taken to a prison where you have to perform a heist to get out.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so the different rooms are different things you have to go through in order to get out of this prison. So I did kind of bear a little bit of bodily damage because there was one where we were going through a tunnel that spewed out 100 plus per mile hour winds.
Wow.
It was to the point where I was knocked into by the guy that was in front of me. He fell backwards onto me. and so hit my lip pretty hard, but I trudged forward, I trudged along, and I actually made it through that tunnel, so I was very, very proud of myself.
Right, congrats. That was, yeah, that's crazy. I don't think I would have survived that.
Thank you.
So when it comes to these rooms and these sort of dynamics, how does it work in terms of the crowd? Is it like everyone goes in at once to each room, or is it like one by one, or how does that work?
So everyone goes in at once, but it's only like 4 to 5 people that go in.
Mm.
So it's a very like little tiny crowd that you go with, and you basically can either go with like your little group, or you go with a couple of strangers and like yourself or the couple of people that you're with. So it's a very different experience.
Do you stick with these people like throughout each room, or is it like once you're through the room you just move on by yourself?
No, you stick with them throughout the entire thing.
Okay, so this is a very like sort of intimate experience of like you stick with the same group throughout the entire process. Yes.
Unless they don't want to do something with you. So either they can opt out of doing it and they watch you do it, or they can skip the room and then you meet them on the other side.
Okay.
Mm.
So, like I said, everything is based on consent there, which I didn't expect going into it. I just thought it was going to be something where it was, like, so insane that, like not necessarily McCamey Manor-esque, if you guys know what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But something kind of along the lines of that. But everything is like, they really do treat you well there. If you really don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. And trust me, I was wearing that mercy pendant. I was wearing that mercy pendant.
And then I know you also spoke to the owners. Do you want to share a little bit about like what led to the creation of this haunted house and like their experience before and throughout it?
Yeah, so I talked to Heather, and she opened, Heather Luther,
mm-hmm.
and she opened up the haunt with her husband, Robbie Luther, and she basically kind of told me that, like, first date she went on, they were already talking about, so, what if we do this together, what if we do these things together, and, you know, at the time, she went from working a payroll and marketing job at her dad's company, mm-hmm. she was working at a McDonald's, to kind of saying, oh my gosh, I love scary things, and I love this idea of doing a haunted house kind of experience. And they kind of just put everything they had into it and like just went from there. And so the haunt opened up in September of 2015. In which she told me that they almost barely did not survive because of it, because they were working like 20-hour shifts there. They were sleeping at the haunt, and they barely saw their kids at the time, and she told me that their kids were really, really young when they were trying to start this up, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
And going through all that kind of process to sort of get this off the ground, how has it sort of changed over time in its, like, 10-year history?
Well, they always, from what Heather's told me, they are always looking for ways to outdo themselves. And they also teamed up with a couple other owners who are able to kind of bring the haunt a little bit more to life. So between Robbie and then the other owner, Adam, they can basically do anything and create anything that they want. So it was very intense already at first, and it was very unique at the time. It still is, because they always are trying to outdo themselves. Basically, is according to Heather.
Thank you for coming, as always.
Of course, your light is going back.
It just got so much darker in here.
Oh my god, I can't believe it.
No, for real.
Goodbye, Sarah.
Goodbye.
Bye, Sarah. All right, we're going to jump into a little bit of news, and to help us out, we have our editor-in-chief, Jaden Lovelady, here to discuss the Ollie program with us and some of the updates with them.
Yes, hello. Good to be back.
We missed you so much.
Yeah.
I missed it here, to be honest. God. Yeah, so I've been covering this story with Ollie for a few weeks now, and basically the campus, due to the record enrollment of, you know, over 45,000 students this year, this mm-hmm. is the largest in the CSU system, they've tried to kind of mitigate the effects of such a large student body by considering, like, the space that we have on campus.
Yeah.
So the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute is, like, could be facing relocation within the next academic year.
So what is the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute?
Yeah, so it's a program on campus. It's defined on their website as the program that provides active older adults with the opportunity to continue learning. I would say the typical demographics around, like, retirement age, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's a largely operated by volunteer work. And, yeah, it's just classes that older adults can take on campus and stuff. They've been in Ruby Gerontology Center for 37 years.
Wow. Though.
And my understanding is that they played a large role in the funding for that building getting made through, like, fundraising and donations and stuff like that. So there was a little bit of pushback when the university, like, pitched to them that they might be facing relocation in the next academic year. So, yeah, I've just kind of been following the story. I went to their town hall a few weeks ago. I talked to some people in the university to see kind of what's going on. And although, like, they did play such a large role in, like, the creation of the building, if you could say that, it does explicitly say in the contract that it still is, like, under university control and mm-hmm. under state control, like, because of that. So, you know, the university does have a right to ask them to move. But so now, like, as it stands right now, the president and Ollie are creating an advisory council from 5 from the university and 5 from Ollie to kind of oversee, I don't know, to oversee the conversations of, like, you know, the needs that Ollie needs met in a new location and, like, where that's going to be on campus and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then I know the university has, like, posed that the program would need to move. Did the university state, like, what they would need to use the Ruby Gerontology Center for?
Yeah, so not for any, like, major specifically or anything yet, but I do know that, like, it kind of just goes back to the fact that we have the largest student body in the CSU system, you know?
Yeah.
It's mostly, like I said, it's just to kind of account for the fact that we have so many students now who want to take all of these different classes. Like, and I know we've added new majors just this semester and we're not even halfway through. So it's just, I would say, like, from the conversations I've had with, like, the president and, like, his, I don't know if you can call it a cabinet, but the president and his people, like, it's kind of just to, like, prepare for the ever-evolving, yeah, like, nature of campus, I guess.
Kind of, like, to mitigate against, like, such a large student body, giving the students, like, somewhere else to have their classes and sort of be at?
Yeah, because, like, RGC has one of the biggest lecture halls mm-hmm. on campus, if not the biggest, I'm pretty sure. So they could use that space for a lot more from their perspective, and, yeah.
Yeah, and then from the other side, what are some of the concerns that, like, Ollie members cited about, like, potentially being moved to another location on campus?
Yeah, so as far as I know, the two locations offered so far have been either somewhere in McCarthy Hall or in Titan Hall. Titan Hall was the most, like, pushed for option, I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure. And I spoke with Ollie's president, Vicky Hike, and the past president, Mike Stover, about this, and, you know, just from going from their town hall, too, like, a lot of people have voiced concern over the fact that it's, like, removed from campus. Like, it's fully, it's part of campus, but it's across, like, a very, very busy street, and then that would be implying that you know, a large part of their demographic is, like, 80s and upwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
there's a lot of potential mobility issues, yeah, with, among that demographic.
Yeah, like, they don't have the same, like, challenges that the typical demographic of a university has, you know, is what they've been yeah, telling me. Another thing that the Ollie president touched on was that, like, I'm pretty sure there are, like, regulations in place for, like, you know, retirement homes and stuff like that that, like, they would want out of a new location. I know, like, I didn't quite cite this in the article, but I know in our conversation she said, like, they're worried about, like, disaster planning. Like, what if there's a fire and mm-hmm. they don't use elevators anymore? How are you expecting a ton of, like, older adults to come up a ton of stairs like that if they're in the basement or if they're across the street in Titan Hall and something like that?
Yeah, I know we were also discussing earlier, like, some of the concerns with McCarthy, like, changing the location to McCarthy specifically mm-hmm. is, like, the building's age, which, like, would kind of enhance those accessibility issues for the population of people who are in Ollie.
Yeah, I, quite honestly, right now, like, I don't have a solid answer for that because I haven't gotten one from, you know, university admin because this mm-hmm. is so new. Like, this is a very, like, evolving conversation, if you could say that. Like, that's why they're creating this advisory council, and that's something that happened this week. So they're finding members to put on the advisory council for both sides. So yeah, as this continues, like, I'm sure we'll get more, like, cold hard fact answers, you know, but as of right now, it's all just really, not theoretical, but, like, really... both of them have used the word collaborative a lot, so they're working together to try and mitigate, like, the damages and the effects of, like, a relocation if that does happen. I do know that the president told me that he has given them, like, a June of 26 date, kind of, like, to think backwards from, so hopefully before then they'll have a plan in place and... you know, all of the kinks will be worked out.
Yeah. And then could you speak to the probability of, like, a relocation occurring before June 26th? Or is that also kind of up in the air?
That also is just... Yeah, all of this is just very new. Like, they're not giving me, like, hard answers because I don't even think they have them yet, you know? But I think that's a good sign of it being so...
You know, it, like, provides more opportunity.
It's not, like, up in the air, but it is more of a collaborative nature. Because in the beginning, that's why there was such an emotional pushback from Ollie. Because they told me that they felt like a lot of things were not considered when relocating a program like Ollie. And now they don't feel that way anymore. So there is progress, like, being made towards decisions. But it's, again, just kind of, like... a lengthy process to get so many people involved and have so many different perspectives in a conversation like that. But it's definitely something I'm going to follow, like, moving forward. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Okay, with this concerning the RGC, which does hold the Mackey Hall, one of the largest lecture halls on campus.
Right.
If you were able to teach anything in that hall, what are you teaching?
That's a really hard question. I think I am going to steal a class from another university. I have a friend at LMU who's taking a Gothic literature class, and it focuses on, like, vampires. I feel like if I had to teach a class, I'd just do history of vampires, and I think that would be so fun.
Wow, that's an answer. Well, mine is kind of related. I think I would do a history on emo bands.
That's good.
And, okay, it'd be taught by unit. Okay, we have My Chemical Romance, we have Panic at the Disco.
Okay,
I'll have, like, to think about the other ones, but those are the two most important to me.
So. That's the final and the midterm right
That's the stuff that I know the most about. So I will be teaching a history class on these two bands, I think.
Okay. That's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
I think if I could get the Mackey Hall, I'm doing a 3-hour cooking expo every week.
Mm.
Yeah. We just making beef Wellington week one.
Can you, like, explain to me how that would look? Because Mackey Hall is, like...
No, it's not the students cooking.
It's just them watching you cook.
It's them watching me cook and just taking notes on what they're going to do when they get home.
Have you considered that, like, Mackey Hall, past, like, the fifth row, you cannot see what's in front of you?
But that's why they have the giant screen in the back. See, I thought this one through.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. What would you do second week?
Ooh, if we're doing beef Wellington week one, we'd have to do a dessert second week to, like...
Have you ever made beef Wellington in your life?
So, week two, we're going to be doing apple pie.
Okay.
Have you ever made apple pie in your life?
Week three, we're going to move on to some pastas.
I've actually got to go.
Okay.
This is going to be...
Yeah, you're right. You have to go because you're going to miss cooking expo if you don't leave now.
I think it's time to cut this short.
Yeah. Wow. See you guys later.
See you later.
Bye.
Hey Titans, this is Sergio Gonzalez, the digital managing editor of The Daily Titan. Stay connected and follow us at The Daily Titan on social media. Be sure to pick up a paper on campus in the Orange newsstands. And if you want more stories, check us out online.
We're going to kick it on over to sports.
Was it a good week?
I don't know, you'd have to ask the digital managing editor and stand-in sports correspondent Sergio Gonzalez.
Would he be here with us tonight?
You'd have to ask him.
I may or may not be. I want to talk about men's soccer.
Ooh.
Tell us more about men's soccer.
Men's soccer lost on Saturday night to UC Davis.
So what did you see out on the field?
I saw a very collaborative defensive effort turn into a very bad one. They held them UC Davis scoreless to 78, and then they scored two in the last 12 minutes. The second of which was obviously the game-winning goal, with 55 seconds to go.
Wow.
Yeah, and this was a very physical match. Both teams were super aggravated from my perception.
I mean, like, I saw the pictures on your camera. Like, yeah, it looked like there was a lot of rough and tumble out there.
There was one point in time, I swore there were like four or five bodies just flying. Like, I'm being so serious. Yeah. Like,
not even
they
foul
were
baby?
Pushing each other. Like, a bunch of fouls were being called, but also a lot of fouls weren't being called. I feel like the referee did play a role in everyone's overall like disgruntlement. I feel like UC Davis, they carry themselves with a lot of intensity. Our own assistant sports editor, Charlie Rondo, was there, and he interviewed Coach Kuntz. And George Kuntz said that one thing about this UC Davis team is that they're always super physical. And he said the one thing that they struggled with was that they couldn't match their physicality. And obviously that showed at the very end, and UC Davis controlled the ball a lot more than Fullerton did. Fullerton, they did have their least amount of shots since September 11th.
It was 10, right?
Yes. And they've been, like, the best, like, offensive team in the Big West. So, definitely a bit of a drop-off, but...
And I'm sure there's, like, a level of disappointment because this game would have clinched them the number one seed in the Big West as well.
That is a big part of the disgruntlement, to be honest. I would say it was kind of... I mean, when you factor that in and the fact that they had a lead with about, like, 12 minutes to go, this is a team that boasts their defense and they've had such a strong defensive line throughout the season. Just could not convert at the very end. And now it sucks because they're tied with UC Santa Barbara at the top of the leaderboard. They have one game left. UC Santa Barbara has one game left. UCSB, they play UC Sun, who is at the very bottom of the standings.
Ooh.
I don't want to say it's an easy win, but I mean, like, you never know, of course.
Just
but
on paper, like, it seems like it's pretty doable for them.
It's in their favor. And
For us, what does that look like on our end?
Fullerton goes up against UCSD, who only has one conference win.
Mm.
So, obviously... We'll see. We'll see what happens. If they both win, I believe UCSB has a tiebreaker because they defeated Fullerton 1-0 earlier in the season. But it really ties back into this UC Davis game of what a blown opportunity that was.
Definitely. Because this could have secured the future for them, at least.
For sure.
What do you expect out of them coming into their next game in terms of how this went?
I expect them to... I mean, they have a lot of time to regroup because they don't play until Saturday. So they have the full week to focus, regroup. Get their minds right, because I feel like soccer is like a big mindset game, and that's something that was lost towards the very end of that game. They're on the road, so it's a bit of a challenge, but I feel as if this team is built to win. They've had a very solid conference season. They're 5-2-1, and they were leading in first place throughout the whole season. So, obviously a bit of a setback with the loss on Saturday, but I do believe in this team, and I feel as if they can still come out on top at the end.
Absolutely. I do have one question for you, though.
Mm-hmm.
You're very passionate about this team. You're very passionate about Fullerton Athletics as a whole. If you were the coach and you had to give a little locker room speech to your soccer team coming into their next game, what are you telling them before they hit the field?
That's a good question, actually. Let me think. It sounds like corny, but it's just almost like, how bad do you want it? I feel like that's something you kind of just have to remind yourself, like, often of, like, I don't know, like, I think sports is such a mindset-driven, like, niche. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just feel as if, like, the guys that want it more, it normally reflects on the court or on the field or wherever it is, you know?
Yeah.
So I almost feel as if I would lead a speech someone in that direction. I probably can't give you the exact words.
That's okay.
But definitely something along those lines.
Okay, then. I think you got to go talk to those boys.
I think so, too. Kuntz just hit my line. I'm going to head over.
Oh, yeah, you got that. We'll catch you next week. Hopefully.
Cool. Yes, sir.
Bye.
Bye.
Next up, we have the most important sports story of the night, an opinion written by assistant Litzy Aguilar discussing Bad Bunny's future Super Bowl performance and the controversy surrounding it.
Yeah, I thought this story was really interesting because it highlights a lot of good points about American culture and sort of the stages that we set for artists to sort of display their level of community. Yeah. Like, the story really centers on the fact that there's been sort of, like, public outcry, especially from, like, political officials about Bad Bunny being selected to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show.
And I think it's important to note that the controversy fully just centers around Bad Bunny's heritage, both as a Spanish-speaking musician and as a Puerto Rican.
Yeah, I'm glad you sort of mentioned it in that order because it seems like they're focusing a lot more on his just the fact that a lot of his music is in Spanish rather than the fact that he's a Puerto Rican, which is a U.S. territory, therefore making him a legal U.S. citizen.
Absolutely. I think specifically having a lot of the controversy and like public outcry from people who are disappointed at Bad Bunny's being chosen to be the Super Bowl halftime performer centers around him speaking Spanish, and it kind of ties into a lot of political controversy that is kind of that people are seeing currently surrounding certain political officials and certain people on like a
This article brought up a really good point in the fact that Bad Bunny has already played the Super Bowl halftime show. He was a part of J-Lo and Shakira's show a couple years back. Mm-hmm. And back then in there was 2020. And there was no issue with him doing his verse in Spanish on a stage in front of hundreds of millions of people or anything like that. And yet now in today's current political climate, him being a primarily Spanish-speaking artist is an issue. And it comes at the same time where people are being deported just for speaking their native language, just for being a part of the community they come from. It feels very much like this is a social, political sort of motivated controversy rather than just like a critique of his quality of art.
And I think another thing that the article brings up is that, yes, it becomes a social, political issue when you have public officials speaking out about it, such as Kristi Noem talking about how she's going to deploy ICE at the Super Bowl. But furthermore, Litzy talks about how just these halftime show performances in general kind of serve as political statements.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even last year with Kendrick Lamar's performance at the halftime Super Bowl show, there was a level of political motivation or sort of political ideology imbued in that as well. He had Samuel Jackson dressed up as Uncle Sam, different quotes about America and America's history intertwined throughout his performance.
Yeah, and I think it just comes from the fact that, also discussed in the article, the Super Bowl game in general has become a lot larger than just like an American tradition.
So absolutely,
the reach that one can have from the ads that come from the Super Bowl, the halftime performance specifically, it has a lot more reach than would be available at like other games.
No, or even definitely
other like musical platforms.
And especially with the NFL and Super Bowl sort of looking to expand to the rest of the world beyond just America, it would make sense for them to have an artist that speaks a language that's very widely popular throughout the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've started hosting games in other foreign countries of American football. Why wouldn't they showcase other cultures of the world in a way that highlights them and showcases their importance to America as well?
I agree. I do think that there also should be a distinction that, like, having somebody who speaks Spanish on the stage at a Super Bowl performance is not un-American in and of itself. Like, I think a lot of the controversy and, like, people who are disappointed in this, it stems from their belief that the American language, the language of the United States, is English. And while it's a really popular language in the country, I think it is just important to recognize that there are there's such a wide variety of people that exist within the country, most of those being people who are bilingual, who primarily speak another language.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also think that him speaking Spanish shouldn't be an issue, and again, like, doesn't make any sense for there to be controversy, because up until March of this year, there was no designated official language for the U.S. Mm-hmm. There was no predominant culture of, like, oh, we speak only English or anything like that. This has always been a stage for people to speak on what's important to them, whether it's national politics, personal causes, things like that. This is the largest stage in the world that people can utilize to spread a message that not only makes others aware, but also lifts up marginalized communities. Absolutely. And that's happened time and time again. So for there to be controversy simply because one specific person is doing it for one specific community nowadays is just, it seems dumb.
Absolutely. And I think even the fact of there being no official designated language in the U.S. up until this March kind of ties into the fact that because of the ever-changing political climate, people have been finding, like, themselves increasingly frustrated with political discussions on a larger basis. But this article also points to the fact that pop culture, art in general, music in general, has always had political ties and roots.
Absolutely. And I don't see why this year's Super Bowl should be any different.
I don't.
Because then he's also a great performer. I mean, he puts on good concerts, he gets the crowd moving, like, regardless of whether or not you speak the language, he makes good music, and people would want to see that.
Amazing music.
And the NFL wants good entertainment. So
are we for getting mad at good music now? I don't believe this.
All right, so we touched on it briefly, and it's also been mentioned in the article.
Yeah.
That Bad Bunny made a guest appearance at the Super Bowl halftime show back in 2020 with J-Lo and Shakira. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you were performing at the Super Bowl halftime show.
Okay.
Who would you want as your guest appearance to come out and support you on stage?
Oh, that's a really good one. Wow. I don't know. Do you have an answer ready for this?
Ooh. If I was on stage performing at the Super Bowl and I could have anyone come out to support me, I would want the entirety of the LA Philharmonic Orchestra.
That is really beautiful.
Yeah.
I think bouncing off of that, I have an even more beautiful answer.
Oh, yeah?
Glee Original Cast.
Wow.
Glee original cast. I'm not even singing. I skip around them and I clap really happily when they do covers.
No, that's beautiful. You I got think it. So you too. Got it. Yeah.
Super Bowl, let me okay. know.
Okay, we need to call Mr. Goodell. We need to handle this.
And that's it for this week's episode of the DT Pod. Be sure to pick up a copy of the Daily Titan on campus or check us out at dailytitan.com to read the articles mentioned in today's episode. Thank you all for listening, and as always, if you like us, we love you.
Alright Titans, don't go anywhere just yet, because you know we gotta take a moment to get real thankful around here. So first of all, we're gonna start off this round of thanks with a big old thank you going out to our executive producers Sergio Gonzalez and Jaden Lovelady. We're gonna follow that one up with another thank you to our producer Michelle King. And then we're gonna take that thank you and roll it into another thank you and hand that off to our assistant producers Giselle Medina and Raniel Santos. We're gonna take all those thank yous and combine them into a larger thank you and give that over to Bijan Sucerisade for providing the music you hear in this episode. And we're gonna take all of those previously mentioned thank yous and combine them all into one giant, giant thank you and give them all to you, the listeners, for tuning into this week's episode. Please make sure you pick up a copy of the broadsheet when you're out on campus. Tap in on dailytitan.com to read even more articles, and we'll see you guys next week. Peace.